Hello and welcome to the Minimum Competence episode for Monday, May 6, 2024. I'm your host for today, Andrew Leahy, a tax and technology attorney from New Jersey. On today's episode, we're covering new U.S. overtime rules, Massachusetts' adoption of six-person juries, Berkshire's legal battles over wildfire claims, and UAW's labor negotiations. Let's remember, the sound of rain needs no translation, and read today's legal news. On May 6, 1882, this day in legal history, a pivotal moment in U.S. immigration history occurred with the signing of the Chinese Exclusion Act by President Chester A. Arthur. This federal law marked the first and only time that the United States explicitly barred a specific ethnic or national group from immigrating to the country, specifically targeting Chinese laborers. The act not only prevented Chinese workers from entering the U.S., but also prohibited them from becoming U.S. citizens, denying them the legal rights and protections afforded to citizens. The enactment of the Chinese Exclusion Act was driven by widespread anti-Chinese sentiment in the Western U.S., where economic competition, racial prejudice, and cultural misunderstandings had stoked public and political pressure against Chinese immigrants. Labor movements, particularly on the Pacific coast, rallied against Chinese laborers who were often scapegoated for low wages and economic hardships experienced by white workers. Senator Joseph Hawley of Connecticut stood as a vocal opponent of the act, predicting its harsh judgment by future generations. His prophetic criticism highlighted the injustice embedded in the legislation, foreseeing its negative historical assessment. Indeed, the act was seen in hindsight as a significant breach of American ideals regarding immigration and equality. The Chinese Exclusion Act laid the groundwork for subsequent restrictive immigration policies. It was not until December 17, 1943, amid World War II and shifting geopolitical alliances, that the Magnuson Act was passed by Congress at the behest of President Franklin D. Roosevelt. This act repealed the Chinese exclusion laws, albeit with limited Chinese immigration still imposed, and allowed Chinese residents in the U.S. to become naturalized citizens, signaling a slow transformation in American immigration policy towards inclusivity. Today, the Chinese Exclusion Act is often studied as a stark, though not unique, example of racially discriminatory legislation, reminding us of the ongoing journey toward broader civil rights and equality in America. The U.S. Labor Department has introduced a new rule to expand overtime protections, which is causing concern among employers about potential legal challenges similar to those experienced in 2016. Previously, an attempt to increase overtime eligibility was halted by federal courts just days before its implementation, causing confusion for businesses that had already adjusted pay and staffing. The current rule aims to increase the salary threshold for overtime eligibility among white-collar workers under the Fair Labor Standards Act. Starting July 1st, employees making less than $43,888 annually will be eligible for overtime, expanding to less than $58,656 by January 1st, capturing an additional 4 million workers. Employers face the choice of either raising salaries to maintain exemption or restructuring staffing to manage overtime costs. The new rule represents a significant increase from the current threshold of $35,568, with a projected economic impact including a $1.5 billion annual income shift from employers to workers. This change not only increases wages through overtime, but also by encouraging salary raises to keep certain employees exempt. Despite the risk of legal setbacks, businesses are advised to prepare for the changes, assessing their economic and cultural impacts and making necessary adjustments. This rule is also expected to positively affect the workforce by potentially increasing hiring and converting part-time jobs to full-time positions. These substantial changes in salary thresholds affect millions of workers, making it a crucial legal and economic issue. In Massachusetts, the practice of using six-person juries in civil cases, initially a necessity during the pandemic, is finding continued favor among litigants, lawyers, and judges due to its efficiency. The state Supreme Judicial Court had mandated smaller juries as a temporary measure, but reverted to the standard 12-person juries in January. Despite this, the legal community is less insistent on the larger jury size, recognizing the speed and cost-effectiveness of smaller juries, especially given the ongoing backlog of cases caused by court closures during the pandemic. Judges and attorneys have observed that smaller juries expedite the trial process from jury selection to trial proceedings, as they reduce logistical complications like scheduling conflicts among jurors. For example, Massachusetts Superior Court Judge Peter Krupp noted his positive experiences with juries of 6 to 8 members, highlighting their efficiency in managing cases. Additionally, the flexibility in jury size is seen as a tool to help clear the dockets and maintain the flow of judicial processes. While there is some concern about the potential impact of smaller juries on trial outcomes, with opinions varying depending on whether a party has the burden of proof, the consensus is that smaller juries do not inherently disadvantage either side. They also minimize the risk of a hung jury by reducing the number of jurors who might disagree. Nonetheless, the importance of preserving critical jury selection processes like peremptory challenges and thorough voir dire, that's jury selection, is emphasized to ensure that smaller juries remain fair and unbiased. Overall, the shift towards smaller juries is seen as a practical adaptation that balances judicial efficiency with the need for fairness in the legal process, suggesting that this practice may continue to be utilized to manage the caseload effectively while addressing the constraints of the judicial system. Berkshire Hathaway, the conglomerate headed by Warren Buffett, faces significant legal challenges regarding its utility business, particularly with wildfires in Oregon. Greg Abel, recognizes Buffett's likely successor, stated that during Berkshire's annual shareholder meeting that all litigation against the utility, specifically targeting PacifiCorp, is baseless and will be contested. This statement follows a recent lawsuit where 1,000 victims claimed $30 billion in damages, alleging PacifiCorp's responsibility for the 2020 Oregon wildfires. This comes in addition to $825 million already paid or owed by PacifiCorp for other related wildfire claims. Abel acknowledged that managing wildfire risks has been a substantial challenge, marking the first time such issues have caused considerable financial strain on one of Berkshire's utilities. Despite methods available to utilities to mitigate wildfire risks, such as insulating wires, managing vegetation, and burying transmission lines, the practice of shutting off power during high-risk scenarios was not initially adopted by PacifiCorp. Abel noted that the cultural focus at Berkshire's utility companies had been on maintaining power supply, especially to critical services like hospitals and fire stations, even during wildfires. Recently, legislative actions in Utah have allowed utilities to impose surcharges to fund wildfire prevention and limit liability on certain claims, which Abel referred to as the gold standard. Moving forward, Berkshire is adjusting its policies to shut off power proactively during wildfires and is investing cautiously in its utility operations to enhance their safety and reliability without unnecessary expenditure. Abel emphasized the importance of disciplined investment in this area, reflecting Buffett's philosophy of avoiding further loss by not investing additional resources unwisely. The United Auto Workers, or UAW, successfully ratified a new labor agreement with Daimler Truck, continuing its recent series of successful negotiations that began with the Detroit 3 automakers last fall. This progress in labor negotiations underscores a significant period of union activity aimed at expanding UAW's influence within the auto industry, especially targeting non-union U.S. factories primarily owned by foreign automakers. A significant milestone was achieved when workers at Volkswagen's Chattanooga plant in Tennessee voted to join the UAW, an effort led by UAW President Sean Fain to unionize American factories operated by overseas companies. This victory is part of a broader strategy to address worker conditions and wages across the industry, notably as the UAW sets its sights on upcoming union votes, such as the one at Mercedes assembly plants in Alabama, scheduled between May 13th and May 17th. The timeline of UAW activities highlights aggressive organizing efforts and strategic negotiations over the past year, marked by notable wage increases across various companies and successful contract negotiations impacting around 150,000 U.S. workers. These efforts are part of a larger UAW campaign to enhance worker rights and compensation in the traditionally non-union sectors of the U.S. auto industry, signaling a potentially transformative period for labor relations in this sector. And with that, I thank you so much for listening to Minimum Competence, your daily news podcast for lawyers. If you're looking for more than Minimum Competence, links to further reading on all the topics touched on today are in the show notes. Reviews go a long way towards helping new listeners to find our show. If you have a moment and can leave a rating or review on your podcast player, we'd sure appreciate it. And if you know someone that might be interested in a story we cover, consider sending them the episode. But remember, nothing here should be construed as legal advice because it is certainly not that. Minimum Competence is available at minimumcomp.com and wherever you get your finely crafted podcasts. If you haven't checked out the website in a while, give it a look. There are complete transcripts and resources for each episode and its corresponding segments, as well as an opportunity to receive new episodes in email, newsletter, form. We'll see you back here tomorrow, and until then, remember, some people feel the rain, others just get wet.